Tel Aviv, and it was a very clear decision on our parliament, which was also followed by the executive decision that one of the reasons why we decided to close that was to ensure that we could force in one way or another the issue of the ceasefire. But if I may just say pretty briefly that, you know, South Africa, we are the beneficiary of one of the most coordinated, solid international solidarity movements since the Second World War, the anti-apartheid movement. And we think today there is a need to revive that spirit of that solidarity. Global anti-apartheid movement in solidarity with the people of Palestine. And we need to be looking at what measures we can take to put pressure on Israel. And if it means severing diplomatic ties, imposing arms embargo, boycotts, isolation of the apartheid regime there, these are all peaceful measures that we can take. They have worked in the case of South Africa, and they can work in the case of Israel.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Francis Moloi, for your time today at Africa Today.
Thank you, Mubarak. It was a pleasure indeed to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, Special Counsel Robert Hur has defended his assessment of President Joe Biden's poor memory as he gave testimony before members of Congress on Tuesday, 12th of March. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Robert Hur, the US Justice Department's special counsel assigned to report on President Biden's possession of classified documents, told Congress he was just doing his job when he shook up the US election campaign by criticizing the president's apparent inability to recall certain events. In his report released in February, Robert Hur, a Republican, former U.S. attorney under Donald Trump, recommended Biden not be charged for possessing classified documents. But he infuriated the president's Democratic allies by making repeated references to Biden's age and memory as one reason for not indicting him, saying jurors would see him as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. Robert Hur said in his opening remarks to the House Judiciary Committee, "My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state and how a jury likely would perceive his memory and mental state in a criminal trial. He defended his comments about President Biden's recollection, saying, "I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the Attorney General my decision and the reason for it. That's what I was required to do." Republicans are also unhappy with Robert Hur's finding that Biden should not be charged, arguing it was evidence of double standards at the Justice Department. A different special counsel, Jack Smith, has indicted Donald Trump for taking government secrets with him after leaving the White House, and, unlike Biden, conspiring to keep them out of the hands of investigators. The Justice Department also decided last year not to bring charges against Donald Trump's former Vice President, Mike Pence, after classified documents were found at his home. Both men were appointed by Biden's Attorney General, Merrick Garland, but operate independently, while Justice Department policy also prohibits the indictment of sitting presidents. The Judiciary Committee's chair, Trump ally Jim Jordan, sought to focus public attention on Robert Hur's conclusion that President Biden willfully retained and disclosed classified materials after his vice presidency. Jim Jordan said, "Mr. Hur produced a 345-page report, but in the end it boils down to a few key facts. Joe Biden kept classified information, Joe Biden failed to properly secure classified information, and Joe Biden shared classified information with people he wasn't supposed to." Gerald Nadler, the committee's top Democrat, focused on how the special counsel cleared the president and noted his cooperation with the investigation. Gerald Nadler said, "The Hur report represents the complete and total exoneration of President Biden." Recounting the details of the former president's alleged hoarding of classified materials at his Mar-a-Lago resort, Gerald Nadler continued by saying, "And how does that record contrast with President Trump, the documents he retained, and the criminal charges pending against him in Florida?" Nadler said, "Donald Trump is facing charges not because of some vast conspiracy, not because the so-called deep state was out to get him, but because the former president was fundamentally incapable of taking advantage of even one of the many, many chances he was given to avoid those charges." Robert Hur made clear later on that he does not consider his report to be an exoneration of President Joe Biden, saying that, "This is not a word that I used." A transcript of Robert Hur's interview with Joe Biden, which lasted for hours over several days, was released shortly before the hearing began and shows the president fumbled occasionally with a sequence of events and certain dates, but otherwise was sharp throughout the interview and also corrected Robert Hur and others when they made errors. The Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff seized on Robert Hur's insistence that he did not disparage Biden, saying he did just that by including details of the president's ability to recall details in his report. Adam Schiff asked, "You chose a general pejorative reference to the president you understood when you made that decision, didn't you, Mr. Hur? And you would ignite a political firestorm with that language, didn't you?" Robert Hur replied, "Congressman, politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps." Hur said he followed Justice Department policy in writing of his report. Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. Special Counsel Robert Hur has defended his assessment of President Joe Biden's poor memory as he gave testimony before members of the United States Congress on Tuesday, 12th of March. Robert Hur told the House Judiciary Committee that the evaluation was fundamental to his investigation into whether the president intentionally hoarded classified documents during his time out of office. Robert Hur told the committee, "My task was to determine whether President Biden retained or disclosed national defense information willfully, meaning knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids." He added, "For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state." Questions about President Biden's memory arose after Robert Hur released a special report in February that described the president fumbling to recall details, including dates surrounding his son Beau's death. In the report, Robert Hur wrote that Joe Biden, 81 years old, would present to a jury as a sympathetic, well-meaning elderly man with a poor memory. He did not recommend pressing charges against Joe Biden. Nevertheless, his conclusions elicited criticism from both Democrats and Republicans. Democrats have accused the investigator of gratuitously referencing Biden's age, which has become a charge election issue in 2024. Meanwhile, Republicans seized on Robert Hur's report to suggest Biden was getting preferential treatment compared with former President Donald Trump, who has been indicted on charges relating to retaining classified documents. Robert Hur, a registered Republican, addressed the controversy in his testimony on Tuesday, 12th of March. He told the legislators, "My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly."
In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like the dump site in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago, while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further because in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient who's bleeding profusely and saying, oh, it's not so bad. When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea. Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anane. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana. This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Is this the same all over Africa, or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with it?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana. Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched as far as we can that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, and as I say, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anane. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. You happy? Is anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, basically two teams have gone into administration and been taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm. All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call OZEM.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses, it's been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belén and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for 2 euros. A fridge will yield up to 10 euros, and a system unit 4 euros. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, 10 million euros. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belen's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belen's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the third world? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the Gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste, tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals and prisons, and even the gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled. But D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering 3 continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors had been sold for between 50 cents and €2 a piece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo and Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced and their fake recycling company shut down. But Mobo continue to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends €130 billion a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about 40,000 euros. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. In January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste, and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbours. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anane has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material in the first few rows of the container that are working order, but some material sitting behind that that's not working order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use the resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. We've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the controls that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. What about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity. What most people don't know is that a lot of US e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler, they'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. in the limelight.
According to a report, hundreds of people, including children and victims of trafficking and torture, have been convicted and jailed for arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats to claim asylum. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new report, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's asylum laws have introduced a perma-backlog of up to 55,000 people who cannot have their claims processed and risk being left indefinitely in taxpayer-funded temporary accommodation. The Institute for Public Policy Research said that anyone arriving in the United Kingdom via irregular means after 20th of July 2023 cannot have their claim processed and instead will be removed to their home country or to a third country such as Rwanda following the introduction of the Illegal Migration Act. At the same time, pre-existing laws mean that irregular arrivals since 7th of March 2023 cannot be given permission to stay. The think tank said reports suggest that these claims are also on hold. The report says it is highly doubtful that the small country of Rwanda will ever be able to accept tens of thousands of people. Marley Morris, Associate Director for Migration at the Institute for Public Policy Research, said chaos in the Home Office has led to tens of thousands of asylum seekers stuck in a perma-backlog, unable to get on with their lives and costing the taxpayer millions of pounds. This was an entirely predictable outcome of the Illegal Migration Act. The only way to escape this situation is for the Home Office to start processing claims. The Institute for Public Policy Research's warning came as James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, said wealthy nations must help developing ones avoid hemorrhaging people. In a speech in New York on Tuesday, 27th of February, James Cleverly said Western powers must help would-be migrants to stay and thrive at home in order to stem the international migration crisis. Answering questions afterwards, he said there could be large-scale migration to Europe from Africa, the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia, as they become richer and people who were previously too poor to consider relocation acquire the financial means to do so. James Cleverly said, as these parts of the world become wealthier, there may be an initial but potentially temporary pressure for large-scale human movement to the high GDP per capita countries. He argued that Western powers should support these countries in ensuring they are safe and prosperous to prevent an outflow of people and a devastating talent drain. He said, "If you're a country with great aspiration for your future, but what you're synonymous for is just people hemorrhaging from your country, that contradicts your message." An expert in migration questioned James Cleverly's plan. Madeleine Sumption, the director of the Migration Observatory, said research suggested development policies were not an effective way to reduce migration. She added, "It's usually not the very poorest people who migrate, because migrating requires resources. So if low-income countries get richer, sometimes that leads to more migration and not less." She added, "Countries have to become pretty wealthy before people stop wanting to emigrate in substantial numbers. If governments knew how to implement development policies that could achieve that, they'd have done it already." A spokesperson for the Home Office claimed, "We met the Prime Minister's pledge to clear the legacy backlog of asylum cases made before 28th of June 2022, and all of those cases have been reviewed. Now we're working through the next cohort of applications. The spokesperson asserted, we're beginning to implement measures in the Illegal Migration Act following the Supreme Court judgment on Rwanda and alongside the Safety of Rwanda Bill going through Parliament, delivering against this government's priority of tackling illegal migration. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. According to a report, hundreds of people, including children and victims of trafficking and torture, have been convicted and jailed for arriving in the United Kingdom in small boats to claim asylum. The prosecutions have largely slipped under the radar, although the issue has been highlighted by the case of the Senegalese teenager Ebrahim Abar. He was sentenced to 9 years and 6 months detention after being convicted of 4 counts of manslaughter and one of facilitating a breach of immigration law after steering an overcrowded dinghy that got into difficulty, leading to the drowning of at least 4 people. The report, called No Such Thing as Justice Here, from the Centre for Criminology at the University of Oxford and border criminologists, examined the cases of people who have been imprisoned for their arrival on a small boat since the Nationality and Borders Act of 2022 came into force. It used a mix of attendance at more than 100 court hearings, as well as freedom of information requests and interviews with lawyers, convicted asylum seekers, convicted and interpreters. The non-governmental organisations Humans for Rights Network, Captain's Support UK and Refugee Legal Support contributed to the report. It found that the prosecutions have not acted as a deterrent for channel crossings and calls for an end to criminalisation at the border. Between June of 2022 and October of 2023, 253 people were convicted under Section 24 of the 1971 Immigration Act for illegal entry and 7 under Section 25 of that Act for facilitation. According to the research, those targeted for prosecution were either boat drivers like Ebrahim Abar or had immigration history in the United Kingdom, such as having made a previous visa application. In 2021, a series of successful appeals overturned prosecutions under these sections of the 1971 Immigration Act. In response, in June of 2022, the Nationality and Borders Act expanded the scope of criminal offences relating to irregular arrival to the United Kingdom. The offence of illegal arrival was introduced, with a maximum sentence of 4 years imprisonment, and the offence of facilitation was expanded, with a maximum sentence increased from 14 years to life imprisonment. In 2022, one person for every 10 boats was arrested for their alleged role in steering. In 2023, this increased to one for every 7 boats. People have been identified as having their hand on the tiller for many reasons, including having boating experience, steering in return for discounted passage, taking it in turns, or being under duress. Those arrested included people from countries with a high asylum grant rate, including Sudan, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Eritrea, and Syria. Children in age disputes have been charged as adults with the offences of illegal arrival and facilitation for their alleged role in steering boats across the channel. Humans for Rights Network has identified 15 age-disputed children who were wrongly treated as adults following Home Office age assessments and charged with these new offences, with 14 of them spending time in adult prison. They believe there are likely to be more cases. So far, 5 have been confirmed to be children, and the outcome of age assessments is awaited for the others.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The dawns of the month of Ramadan should not be missed. The annual Ramadan Quranic meeting, April 30th, 2019. I request that the Honorable Qura, Quranic experts and reciters of the Holy Quran pay attention to this point. First, they should review in their minds the ayahs that they want to recite. They should deliberate on them and truly absorb the depth of these concepts in their hearts and their belief. They should recite the Holy Quran with this morale and with such preparation. If they do so, their recitation will deeply influence their audience. Of course, you have moved forward to a great extent until today. It is many years now that I have been witness to the movement of the Holy Quran in the country. Today, our youth have made great progress. Our Qur'an and our Quranic experts are really and truly good, but there is still considerable room for exerting more influence. I have written down 2-3 points. One is that you want to convey Quranic concepts to your audience with your recitation.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Although most of your addressees do not know Arabic and the language of the Holy Quran's miracle lies in the fact that even if you try to convey in a deep and efficient way Quranic concepts under these circumstances, that is to say, while your addressees do not know Arabic, they will penetrate the minds of your audience. Of course, this may be done in an incomplete way. Well, this naturally has certain conditions. I listen to the recitations that are broadcast on Radio Tilawat. This medium is a good opportunity for listening to the recitations of the Holy Quran. I listen to the recitations of our Quranic experts and our good Quran. To be fair, our Quran are very good and outstanding in terms of having a good voice. This has been acknowledged by foreign Qura. I have heard them speak highly of Iranian Qura. Some of you really have good and rich voices, which have all the requirements for an outstanding voice, but this should be accompanied by the requirements of recitation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. From all the ways that were wrong, I
think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Economic boycott against the Zionist regime is not a new phenomenon. It hits the apartheid entity where it feels and hurts the most. It is one of the most significant weak spots of the Zionist regime occupying Palestine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, as the low-intensity regional war and transformation take shape in West Asia, the fronts against apartheid Israel and its Western enablers are acquiring a multidimensional character. One of those multidimensional characteristics involves a grassroots economic boycott by consumers of Western and Israeli businesses. Economic boycott against the Zionist regime is not a new phenomenon. It hits the apartheid entity where it feels and hurts the most. It is one of the most significant weakest spots of the Zionist regime occupying Palestine. While purely econometric reasons are certainly important, it is only one of the factors and not the factor. A significant number of Zionist colonizers in Palestine hold foreign citizenship. Figures vary from 10%, according to the Dual Citizenship Report, to 17%, according to Times of Israel report of 2016, to 22%, according to Israeli blogger Daniel Barenboim. There is a speculation that the actual figures may be as high as 35% or even 50% of Israelis holding dual citizenship. They will not stick around in a hostile environment, which will become even more difficult as economic, political, and military pressure continues to increase on the Zionist regime. When a better option is easily available, away from war and economic ruin, not all, but many people will opt for the easier option, leave. Both the current Zionist mass murder campaign in Palestine and the regional resistance to Israel are unprecedented in nature and totally out of proportions. This applies to the economic and boycott angle of resistance against the Zionist regime and its Western enablers. What makes this current limited impact a longer-term strategic challenge to Israel and brands facing the grassroots boycott is that this time, due to the scale of events in the region, more people have joined and it is clearly having some impact. The phenomenon of limited impact creates a vicious perception cycle, which then translates into concrete negative monetary impact. As some brands can no longer conceal that the grassroots boycott is having an impact, more ordinary consumers are motivated by the fact that their objection to genocide in Palestine is working. This results in more people joining the boycott since they feel empowered. this phenomena snowballs into a much bigger boycott movement. Those familiar with the politics of the so-called Muslim street in West Asia and the Arab world know well that boycotting of brands closely associated with Western imperialist regimes has been around for decades. Yet in the past, it was almost never the case that the targeted corporations themselves would admit that they are being impacted. Another factor which is contributing to more impact on the boycott front is the sophistication of the current campaign in terms of technological use and quality of production. For example, Libyan youth produced a video urging boycott of Pepsi has gone viral mainly due to its production quality. The mentioned factors, combined with a significant weakening of Western economies backing the Zionist genocide in Palestine, is on its way to have a lasting effect. Such impact will continue to gain traction even after the guns fall silent in Palestine. Nevertheless, boycott without a broader plan and effort to build alternatives to brands being boycotted is a limited blow to Israel and its enablers. While there are also some grassroots attempts to fill in this gap, like Palestine Cola, being produced in Sweden by two Palestinian brothers, the approach needs to be state-driven.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles De Verre, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign.
We are witnessing a new movement in the world. The atrocities committed in Gaza are no longer only a matter that concerns Muslim countries. Far from it. Here we have a French lawyer that has started an initiative that brought together 300 lawyers from across the world in less than 10 days, and that number grew rapidly to 100,000. And now with the MOU that we have signed at the Iran Judiciary Bar, that number will be rising to 50,000 lawyers. With Iran on board, you can also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
And an optimistic Gilles De Verre, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true, because The humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why while the South African government fights a conflict,